Welcome to the History of the Cold War podcast, episode 112, American Spymaster Alan Dulles. I'm your host, Jeff Hoag. As always, I want to thank our Patreon sponsors and those who have made one-time contributions through the website for helping to make this podcast possible. If you enjoy this podcast and learning about the Cold War, biographies, or espionage, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter or making a donation through our website at www.historyofthecoldwarpodcast.com, one word, or find us on Patreon at patreon.com/coldwarpodcast, all one word. Want to skip over these ads and get straight to the history? Consider becoming a Patreon contributor to get the commercial-free episodes. Institutions shape people and societies for better or worse. Institutions are organizations or groups with their own structure and norms, which are typically built around a shared belief system, worldview, and mission. Most often, these institutions are tied to a wider society or social structure, like a nation state. Institutions represent the building blocks of government, and the CIA became one of these important building blocks of the American government and foreign policy in the Cold War, along with the State Department, FBI, and the U.S. military. However, institutions are very much shaped by their members, especially their leadership, critically so in their early years. They institute the norms, rules, and worldview, very much akin to how J. Edgar Hoover shaped the FBI. Alan Dulles was the leader that significantly shaped the CIA. Again, like Hoover, he wasn't the first director of the CIA, but his tenure was the longest and the most influential, again, like Hoover. Not just because of its length, but because of his managerial style, connections in government, and the private sector. Similar to our other biography episodes, it's important to understand the background and makeup of individuals like Alan Dulles to understand what influences his life experience had on his opinions and beliefs as director of the CIA. Like all our biography episodes, this is not a complete narrative of Alan Dulles' life, but a high-level examination. As I mentioned earlier, it's an attempt to understand his influence on shaping American foreign policy and espionage over the course of the early to mid-Cold War. Some of the information in this episode also overlaps with episode 111, which reviewed the CIA in the 1950s during Alan's leadership of the organization. Alan came from a long line of ministers, diplomats, and spies. On his father's side of the family, his earliest known paternal ancestor, Joseph Dulles, had joined the Dutch East India Company as a boy. While in India, he made his wealth and immigrated from Ireland to America in 1779, where he participated in the defense of Charlestown Harbor in the Revolutionary War. He managed a good marriage to a wealthy Carolinian heiress of a cotton plantation, and they fathered 8 children and many more grandchildren, one of whom was Alan Dulles Sr. His maternal grandfather, John Watson Foster, a Union general in the Civil War, was the Secretary of State for President Benjamin Harrison. In his short tenure as Secretary of State, he had presided over the annexation of Hawaii. His uncle as well was the Secretary of State. Alan Jr.'s older brother, John Foster Dulles, who would also serve as Secretary of State while he was the head of the CIA. Alan's mother, the daughter of John Foster, Edith, had married Alan's father, Alan Sr. Alan Jr. was born in the middle of a blizzard in February the 25th, 1888. Alan had an older brother, who we mentioned earlier, John Foster Dulles, and 3 younger sisters, Margaret, Eleanor, and Natalie. Alan was born with a club foot, actually, and in the past this would have ruined his life, but leading to a lifelong limp. Yet by the late 19th century, medicine had progressed that such ailments in childhood could be corrected in youth. The operation was in fact so successful that very few people knew that Alan had been born with a club foot. Alan grew up in a very intellectually stimulating environment. Beyond attending a very good public school, his parents were both voracious readers, as were his siblings. He also had a private tutor. Unlike many men of that age, his grandfather, General Foster, was highly invested in his grandchildren. They spent the summer with him, and they would often visit him for a few months of the year in Washington, D.C. where the children invariably met some of the leading personalities of the era, such as McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt. As a child, Allen was very curious about the people around him, and the adults around him were willing to take his questions seriously, even as a young boy. As a result, Allen was very interested in the outside world and the news. The Spanish-American War in 1898 and the Boer War really captured the young Allen's imagination. At 8 years old, he wrote a short article entitled The Boer War, some 26 pages that argued the moral and diplomatic aspects of the conflict. General Foster was immensely proud of his grandson's work and shared the document with his friends. Nevertheless, there was a struggle brewing between Allen's father and General Foster about the boy's future. Allen Sr. wanted Allen Jr. and John to follow him into the ministry, whereas the grandfather wanted them to join the excitement of the Foreign Service. Allen's brother John left for Princeton at 16, and when he graduated in 1908, he was class valedictorian. As a result, Allen was in a very competitive environment. It was hard to stand out with his extremely intelligent and talented siblings, especially against his older brother. As a result, from a very young age, Dulles became a very affable person. Most people, even his enemies later in life, liked Allen personally. He was very charming and seductive, versus his brother, who was aloof and introspective. At 15, Allen traveled with the family overseas to Paris to spend the winter with his grandfather. While there, along with his siblings, he learned French. On the weekend, he and the family hiked the French Alps. The following year, though, was largely preparing to take the entrance examination for Princeton, which he was accepted to in 1910. At Princeton, he studied philosophy and won academic honors every year he attended, including a $500 prize in ethics. The real focus of that time at Princeton, though, was on the visionary president of the university, Woodrow Wilson, a former history professor who was later elected governor of New Jersey and in 1912 president of the United States. Allen was among hundreds of students who traveled to Washington for the president's inauguration, the first Democrat at that point to be elected in over 20 years. The Democrats had traditionally been more isolationist in comparison to the internationalist Republicans, who had pushed for American expansion over Hawaii, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Wilson, on the other hand, sought to lead the world through America's exceptional moral superiority. It was all very exciting for a young 20-year-old man with a keen interest in diplomacy and the wider world. Allen was still unsure what to do with his life, though. His father wanted him to become a minister, but Allen found a substitute for the moment doing missionary work in India. After a few months of missionary work teaching, he traveled to Singapore. Then he traveled to revolutionary China. He then passed through Japanese-occupied Korea and then boarded a ship to San Francisco. After returning from overseas, Allen was still unsure what to do. His brother tried to entice him into banking, but he didn't have the heart for the work. He joined the New Jersey National Guard and finally worked up the courage to inform his father that he would be following his uncle and grandfather into the Foreign Service and took the entrance examination. He passed the test with top marks and was assigned to Vienna Embassy. In the meantime, though, his National Guard unit was called up and his unit was ordered to Mexico to catch Pancho Villa. Nevertheless, his local draft board saw his diplomatic service as more important than any role he might perform in Mexico, and he was discharged from his military duties. Arriving in France, Europe was at war, but America was still neutral. Overall, his time in Vienna was not very memorable. He performed many of the day-to-day tasks of a diplomat, stamping passports, checking documents, and helping local American citizens. The biggest event he witnessed was the death of Emperor Franz Joseph, who had ruled Austria-Hungary from the revolutions of 1848 to the horrors of World War I. While there, Allen studied German, becoming somewhat fluent. At the start of 1917, Germany declared unrestricted submarine warfare. In response, the U.S. broke diplomatic relations with Germany, but maintained its embassy in Austria, Germany's ally, for a few weeks longer. That April, though, Allen, along with many of his colleagues, was ordered to Bern in Switzerland, where he was appointed a political officer. As a political officer in a neutral country, Allen worked long hours. In his new position, he sought various contacts in Switzerland that could provide him information about the enemy. With that information he had gathered, he wrote reports, which he sent back to Washington. Many of these early reports dealt with the conditions inside of Germany and the state of the German economy. After several months, DC responded by saying that his reports were highly valuable. Once it was discovered that his uncle and grandfather had been secretaries of state, his reputation within the State Department skyrocketed. Allen did have some missteps in Bern, though. After having first arrived, he received a mysterious phone call from an exiled Russian radical who wanted to meet. Allen was busy, though, with a tennis game that he had planned with an old friend. It turned out that that Russian exile was Vladimir Lenin, the leader of the Bolsheviks. The next day, Lenin left in a sealed train car to Russia. Allen would tell this story for years to young CIA recruits as a lesson as to why they should always take meetings, even if the inquiry seemed vague or unimportant. For years, it was assumed that the story was false or Allen was being hyperbolic, but many years later, the Leninist archives in Moscow confirmed that Lenin had been in Bern that day and he had reached out to Allen. Despite this misstep, though, Allen's career blossomed over his 14 months in Bern. He developed skills in collecting and analyzing political intelligence, and at the age of 25, he was promoted to second secretary. Since Switzerland did not officially celebrate the end of the First World War in November 1918, Allen planned to drive across the border with a friend to France to celebrate. But before that he could go, he became sick, coming down with the Spanish flu. The pandemic would eventually kill more than 20 million people, more than those who had died in the fighting in the First World War. Having survived the Spanish flu, Allen looked forward to the Paris Peace Conference. Both he and his brother John, who had just joined the Foreign Service, sought a coveted position as part of the American delegation. Everyone was excited about the peace conference and how the world would be reshaped. Allen had hoped that his hero, Wilson, could forge a new world safe for democracy, built on open diplomacy, free trade, disarmament, self-determination, and the creation of the League of Nations, which would do away with the need for war. As we have reviewed in many past episodes, though, the Paris Peace Conference not only attracted the leadership of the current world, but future world leaders and others of significance. Ho Chi Minh, Sigmund Rhee, Lawrence of Arabia, Leon Blum, John Maynard Keynes, Walter Lippmann, John Smoots, and Mohamed Mossadegh, just to name a few, many of whom would later play key roles in the Cold War, such as Allen and his brother John. Allen, because of his reports and his role in Switzerland, was immediately selected as a member of the American delegation, as was his brother John. As Allen awaited his brother's arrival in Paris, though, he was actually surprised by his sister, Eleanor, who had volunteered as a nurse and made her way to Europe before the end of the war. In the end, though, Allen's faith in diplomacy and Wilson's new world ran into the reality of the situation. It became quickly apparent that European politics remained mired in the past and that the Paris Peace Conference more closely resembled the Congress of Vienna 100 years earlier than it did anything Wilson and the Americans had sought. As summer turned to autumn, world leaders left Paris to the squabbling diplomats to resolve the finer points. Allen soon grew tired of the project and sought his next great assignment. He was reassigned to the new embassy in Berlin for the new Weimar Republic, the one assignment that might match the action of Paris the previous summer. The U.S. had no clear policy towards the new German state, and Allen had been one of the few arguing for a lenient peace with Germany, especially towards the German businessmen and industrialists who could help bring Germany into the new global market. Indeed, Allen's brother, who represented many American businessmen through his law firm, was keen to take advantage of his brother's Allen's position to invest in German business and industry. In the end, Allen only spent 3 months in Berlin. Having served in the field for 4 years at this point, and now 27, he applied for 2 months' vacation to return home. Returning to the States in April 1920, Allen had more than a few stories to tell from his time in Europe and made the rounds meeting with old friends and attending house parties. While at one, he met his future wife, Martha Clover Todd, a year younger than him. After meeting her once, he returned home and announced to his parents that he had met his future wife and that he was determined to propose to her. His mother, feeling her son was rushing into something, questioned if she had a similar religious background. As it turned out, she did. She did. She was Presbyterian, just like the Dulles family, and there was little the mother and Allen Sr. could do to stop their son from marrying, and a week later, he proposed to her. 2 months later, they were married. They were married 50 years until Allen passed away. It was, however, not a happy marriage. As a result of Allen's work, he and Martha spent long periods of time away from each other and lived very different lives apart from having the three children together. They had contemplated divorce several times over the years. Nevertheless, it always seemed easier for them to remain married versus separating. They were just such unusual people that marriage to anyone else wouldn't have worked either. After their marriage, they moved to Istanbul in 1920. Allen's responsibility included, once again, the protection of American citizens who were largely missionaries and oil executives operating in the Middle East. In 1922, Allen was promoted to division chief for the Near East Division, which covered the Middle East and Africa, and he moved back to Washington. Most of his work involved great power competition over oil rights in the Middle East. Working in Istanbul, Allen had learned a lot about the oil business working with oil executives. Oil executives were also a great source of information about the politics of the various regions and countries, be it a coup in Persia, Jewish riots in the Holy Land, or the civil war in Arabia. While back in Washington, Allen and his brother John began a lifelong obsession with the chess. Over these long games of chess, John convinced his brother that even if he was going to remain in the Foreign Service, he should obtain his law degree. Allen took his advice and signed up for night classes at George Washington University, ironically the same program J. Edgar Hoover had attended some years before. Allen spent the summer of 1925 at a diplomatic conference in Switzerland. However, he was due for a new posting overseas, and he was appointed a counselor in Peking. He was able to delay this assignment, though, while he completed his law degree. In 1926, he and Martha traveled back to Geneva for a disarmaments conference. Nevertheless, Allen never took up his post in China. His uncle advised him not to take the appointment, as, quote, "the problems of China will not be solved in your lifetime," close quote. Additionally, Allen was no longer the single bachelor in his early 20s. He was now married and a father with a family to support. Although being promoted, Allen's pay was meager, and it was difficult for him not only to support his family, but to keep up with his friends and family, who were on average very wealthy. As a result, Allen resigned the State Department in 1926 to take a lucrative offer with his brother's law firm. Allen wasn't high-ranking in the State Department, but as he was well-known and seen as an upcoming star and a probable future Secretary of State. Newspapers were quick to report that Allen, a diplomatic whiz kid of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, grandson and nephew of two recent Secretaries of State, had resigned. Many papers, including the New York Times, blamed this resignation in part on poor pay of diplomats and argued that such professionals needed to be paid more if they hoped to retain such talent in government. I want to take a quick break here and, again, thank our Patreon contributors and those who have made one-time contributions for helping to make this podcast possible. Your support helps to pay for hosting the podcast, the website, recording equipment, and books. Without this support, we wouldn't be able to bring you the show. So if you enjoy learning about espionage history like this episode, or if you enjoy our biography episodes, please consider supporting the show. To do this, visit our website at www.historyofthecoldwarpodcast.com, all one word, or visit us at Patreon at www.patreon.com/coldwarpodcast. Any amount helps and is deeply appreciated. If you're tired of hearing me e-beg for money, becoming a Patreon supporter will also grant you access to our commercial-free episodes. Moreover, as a Patreon supporter, you also get access to our after episodes in which myself and Dave do a quick debrief about the show, and you get my personal opinions on events and topics we examined in the show. Moreover, you gain access to our special content, like our series of episodes around my views on the current Russo-Ukrainian war and the wider context of the Second Cold War. Now back to the show. Allen's brother's firm, Sullivan & Cromwell, wasn't a typical law firm, but a firm that represented banking and industrialist interests outside of the United States, in South America, Europe, and Asia. which invested in mining, railroads, and industry. With such clients as J.P. Morgan, General Electric, Ford, U.S. Steel, to name just a few. In the 1920s, governments around the world at the time asked little about companies' financial operations. As a result, many local politicians and bureaucrats were open to bribery and corruption, and the lawyers at Sullivan and Cromwell cultivated these relationships with local politicians and bureaucrats on behalf of their clients. While most of the law firms in the 1920s on Wall Street busied themselves with land deals in Florida, Sullivan and Cromwell's concentrated on financing industry in Germany and Central Europe. Over the next 7 years, the firm managed over $1 billion of investment in Germany and a half of the Dawes plan. $1 billion might not seem like a lot, but that's $1 billion in 1920s money. The firm charged a premium for this type of work, and its partners collected large commissions and bonuses. The firm did offer legal services such as drafting contracts, rights, and wills, and would argue in court, yet their specialty on Wall Street was this overseas connections and influence through bribery, public relations, propaganda, lobbying, intrigue, and finally, even paramilitary operations such as coups or semi-revolutions in Panama. Indeed, Theodore Roosevelt warned his successor, President Taft, to keep his distance from the firm. When legal problems overcame one of its founding partners, William Cromwell, he escaped the country and moved to Europe. Ironically, many of the firm's practices were replicated by the CIA in the late 1940s and 50s to gain influence. It's arguable that Allen's involvement with the firm and his time there influenced the organization and practices of the CIA, especially their joint involvement in the 1954 Guatemalan coup stands out. By 1926, though, a series of resignations and deaths led Allen's brother, John, to become one of the firm's partners. One of his first actions was, of course, to recruit his younger brother straight out of law school. Allen wasn't hired there for, though, his legal skills, nor for his understanding of business. He was hired for his connections in U.S. and foreign governments, acquired over the last 9 years of work in the U.S. State Department, as well as his connections with the newspapers. Despite his work for the law firm, though, he did occasionally do pro bono work for the U.S. government. Sullivan and Cromwell, as well as his brother, tolerated this work as it preserved Allen's contacts within the government and worked to wed U.S. government interests with that of the firm and its clients. As an example, Allen's participation in the 1927 naval disarmament talks in Geneva. The firm's clients included shipbuilding companies and companies like U.S. Steel, which had direct interest in the outcome of these talks. During his 15 years at the firm, he went on 15 extended trips overseas, 7 of which were on behalf of the U.S. government. Allen never questioned the intermingling of government and business interests. He saw them as one and the same. The prosperity of his clients meant the prosperity of the nation, and vice versa. He never saw any contradiction to having a foot in both worlds. This philosophy allowed Allen to reconcile his Wilsonian beliefs with his Republican upbringing. Allen was an American synthesis of these American schools of thought or belief coming out of the 19th century, which were traditionally opposed to each other. While at the CIA, this might have clouded his judgment around the CIA backing for business interests around the world from Iran to Guatemala. He never felt compelled to justify the relationship between the U.S. government and business interests because it was self-evident to him. However, Allen did recognize that although money was important, it wasn't the only interest of the United States, and there were some circumstances in which he thought the interest of the government would supersede that of business. However, again, to him, this would have been the exception, not the rule. Allen's new job gave him the resources to buy a comfortable apartment on Fifth Avenue overlooking Central Park for his young family. Despite the occasional work for the government on disarmament, Allen spent most of his time dealing with the State Department and the firm's clients' holdings in Bolivia, Chile, Denmark, and Sicily. His work at the firm was just that, work. He had very little passion for it, despite his generous pay. Having built himself a reputation for foreign affairs, he also lectured, addressing a diverse set of audiences, from the League of Women's Voters to the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He even appeared on radio and wrote for Foreign Affairs magazine. In 1929, only having been with the firm for 3 years, he was made partner and his financial future was secured. Allen was very well liked in the firm, especially by the younger lawyers, but he was never the force on Wall Street like his older brother. Although a partner, he only made half of what his brother made, and it was clear to everyone in the company who was in charge. Despite them remaining very close over the course of their lives, Allen and his brother, John, remained in different professional and social circles. In 1930, he and his family moved to Paris for a year to learn high finance and to help with the company's European investments and clients. Allen quickly became introduced to the shadowy underworld of 1930s high finance, with its complex and convoluted capital markets, a web of reparations payments, debts, long and short-term obligations, official and private loans, bond disputes, national finances, trade, and government regulations, much of which was corrupted through bribery, favoritism, and nepotism. Overseeing this complex web of relationships was an elite club of central bankers who would often meet discreetly in Bern and Geneva, the old stomping ground from Allen's youth. These bankers discussed all the major financial issues of the day: gold flows, currency values, interest rates, and many of the issues we spoke to earlier. The firm, in this respect, was very interested in spreading the interest of free trade and open flows of money between markets, which made their clients wealthy, and the firm and its lawyers, by extension, wealthy as well. Nevertheless, Allen continued to also do his pro bono work for the government and to continue to grow and cultivate his contacts. In 1933, he met both Mussolini and Hitler. It's important to note that although Allen came from a very Republican background, his brother, of course, was borderline fanatical, he was an internationalist, and he had been inspired by Woodrow Wilson in his youth and a Democrat. Indeed, unlike many of the members of the firm and his family and Wall Street, Allen wasn't hostile to FDR's presidency, and he was eager to help the new administration. Yet at this time, the word internationalist meant many things to many different people. To many on the right, it was synonymous with communism. Moreover, the Republican Party was largely composed of isolationists now. On the left, the term was associated with international finance and banking, which many blamed for the excesses and greed of the 1920s, which resulted in the Great Depression of the 1930s. As a result, Allen didn't really have a political tribe, as neither side embraced his worldview. Indeed, Allen and his brother disagreed bitterly over the 6 years about the rise of fascism in Europe. Allen believed that the U.S. was overlending to these regimes, who would be enemies in the long run, whereas his brother argued that the U.S. should have been more generous loans to Central Europe to avoid war. Allen felt that Hitler and his regime were sinister, though, and that the United States should be preparing for war against Nazi Germany. In 1938, Allen decided to actually run for public office. Despite their disagreements, John fully backed his brother's run for Congress, as did the whole family. He ran against a Democratic candidate and even won the endorsement of the New York Times. Yet Allen lost a close election and never again ran for office. As a result, Allen went back to work at the law firm, but did buy a new home on Long Island, not far from his brother's and even the Roosevelt family. And indeed, Archie and Kim, who would go on to become future high-ranking members of the CIA, became fast friends there. He also became fast friends with the famous Lindberghs. He spent much of the summer of 1939 hosting parties, horseback riding, playing tennis, and teaching his children sailing. Yet as the storm clouds of war gathered in Europe, Allen found himself more and more separated by many of those in his social circle, the Lindberghs being one such example, as Charles Lindbergh led the American First Movement. The intellectual community at that time in America was fairly divided in the late 1930s between those who supported standing up to Hitler and those who supported the policy of appeasement. Many believed that Hitler and the Germans had legitimate grievances and that the Allies, the British and French, had been spiteful and that the Americans had been too unrealistic. at the end of World War I. Allen argued that it was not Woodrow Wilson's idealism which had brought the Nazis to power, but 2 decades of American isolationism. In Allen's view, America could not have survived in a world populated by dictatorships, and that Britain and China should be supported so that America didn't have to fight Germany and Japan alone. If the Axis dominated both Europe and Asia, every American trade route would be under threat. Even if Fortress America could hold out against the Axis powers, America would become a much more militarized, much poorer society to defend itself for the foreseeable future. In May 1941, William Donovan, who was forming the OSS, reached out to Allen about taking a position with the new secret government agency. He told Allen that he needed a group of consultants in New York who could be advised the government about various phases of international situation. Allen, with the skills from Switzerland, and Sullivan and Cromwell, was one of the few Americans with this skill set. The government job Donovan offered him was the same type of low-paying government position that Allen had left 15 years earlier. Yet in a heartbeat, Allen left his position with the law firm to serve his country in this new capacity. Unlike the young man in his late 20s, he now had made a fortune on Wall Street. He continued to work out of the Sullivan and Cromwell office, though none of his partners knew what he was doing, and he said nothing to friends and family. Moreover, he leased more office space on the 36th floor of the International Center at Rockefeller Center. When the war broke out, Allen was assigned the task of building a national intelligence service for collecting foreign intelligence from business, financial institutions, and scholars in New York and those scattered around the world. In late 1942, he again returned to Bern, Switzerland, where he would spend the rest of the war, in the shadows fighting a conflict of espionage. While there, he used his old contacts and forged new ones to find out what was happening in Germany and Central Europe. He had 25 years of network building he drew on. Allen's wartime record is too detailed to examine here in depth, but suffice it to say he helped play a significant role in OSS operations in Europe and secretly negotiated with the Germans on several occasions. When the war ended, Allen offered to Truman his help in transforming the OSS into a peacetime intelligence agency, which Truman denied, as we saw in past episodes. And on September the 20th, 1945, Truman abolished the OSS, and that December, Allen, for the second time, resigned from government service. Allen wanted to help the Truman administration, but given his brother's stature in the Republican Party, the most they were willing to offer him was a representativeship to China to negotiate air travel rights. Returning to civilian life, Allen's reputation had grown because of the war. He became friends with Prescott Bush, the father of future President Bush 41 and grandfather to Bush President 43, and he became friends with influential newspaper man Walter Lippmann. He also became friends with Forrestal, whose life we reviewed back in episode 13. They both had attended Princeton as undergraduates, but had not known each other socially, and had but shared many similar positions. Both had made their fortunes on Wall Street during the same period as well. Allen was also elected president of the Council of Foreign Relations. Indeed, the Dulles brothers were well known to the elites of Washington, New York, and Europe. Publicly and privately, they spent a lot of time with each other. John was the foreign advisor to Dewey in 1944 and 1948. From the surface, Allen looked to play second fiddle to his older brother, but behind the scenes, he was just as influential, if not more so. In these years, Allen advocated for a lenient peace with the Germans and supported the Marshall Plan. He criticized the idea that removing former Nazis should take precedence over rebuilding the German economy. The Dulles brothers were quickly emerged as the leading minds of U.S. foreign policy in the post-war period. They were both experienced and wise in diplomacy and espionage, having lived through 2 world wars with decades of experience living and working overseas. Many of their mentors and seniors had either retired or passed away. The Dulles brothers were at the forefront of those who argued for the reconstruction of Europe and the Marshall Plan. The big issue of the day, of course, was relations with Russia and the brewing Cold War. Contrary to some conspiracy theories, Allen had kept faith with the Grand Alliance and tried to work with the Soviets to defeat the Germans in World War II. However, by the late 1940s, Allen saw little accommodation that could have they could have with the Soviets. Indeed, he sought, like George Kennan, to contain the Soviets to where they already were, or what became known as containment theory. Again, similar to Kennan, he believed that in the long run, the Soviet Union wouldn't survive given its dictatorial nature. In 1948, as Dewey's election seemed a foregone conclusion, Forrestal approached Allen about running the new CIA and the new Dewey presidency, with his brother as Secretary of State and Forrestal keeping his post as Secretary of Defense. Allen already agreed on conducting a formal assessment of the CIA in anticipation of taking leadership. Yet, as we saw, Dewey was defeated in 1948 election and Truman won a second term, dashing the plans of the Dulles brothers and the rest of the Republican establishment. His formal assessment of Truman's CIA, instead of being a blueprint to rebuild the agency, it became a doorstop. Allen's age also started to become an issue. His gout, an issue which had plagued him on and off, grew worse, and he started to walk with a limp, and he caught pneumonia and had to be hospitalized. Moreover, with Truman's victory in 1948 and Allen's association with his brother, Dewey and Forrestal, whom Truman regarded as a traitor, his chances of going back into government were greatly diminished. With his prospects for government work faded, Allen started to work on his own to counter the Soviet threat. He established the Free Europe Committee, the cornerstone of which was the radio station Radio Free Europe, which broadcasts news and entertainment into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. However, although they claimed to be privately funded, in reality, they were partly funded through the government. Despite the U.S. public being unaware of the connection, the Soviets knew right away and quickly focused their attention on Allen. The Soviets had noted that Allen had returned to Switzerland, and other former OSS colleagues moved to Berlin and Istanbul. It was clear to the Soviets that Allen was using his business, Sullivan and Cromwell, as cover, and that in reality he was working for the U.S. government. The outbreak of the Korean War changed things for Allen. Despite Truman's reservations, he was brought back into the administration to assist General Walter Beadle Smith at the CIA. As a result of Smith's stomach illnesses, Smith brought Allen in as deputy director for plans, eventually promoting him to deputy director of the CIA. Allen and Beadle Smith never saw eye to eye, though, despite Allen's ability to charm even many of his opponents. The two men just never got along. Smith, coming from a military background, expected his subordinates, civilian or not, to have a military bearing. Smith had lived a hardscrabble life with no more than a high school diploma, working himself up from the ranks of private to a four-star general, an achievement few men have achieved in history. In fact, Smith was one of the first four-star generals not to graduate from any of the U.S. military academies. Allen, on the other hand, was freewheeling, had grown up very privileged, had graduated from Princeton, and was a member of America's de facto aristocratic elite. Smith respected Allen's experience and expertise in the field of espionage, but he did not trust Allen's judgment or use of American power. It's worth noting that while the war raged in Korea, Allen's son, Allen Jr. or the third, a lieutenant in the Marines, was injured fighting in Korea. The Korean War and the escalation of the Cold War led to an expansion of the agency and its budget doubled. The CIA quickly outgrew its building across from the State Department, and before long, it was in various temporary offices scattered around the capital. With the rush to hire people, regular hiring regulations were waived. Frequently, recruits' civilian pay level was matched, as most were hired straight from Wall Street, law firms, or from university campuses. Most of the OSS veterans despised the newcomers as amateurs and considered themselves the professionals. Many of the new recruits were primarily recruited from America's elite Ivy League schools with very little background in espionage or special operations work. General Smith resented this hiring pattern, complaining that they lacked qualified people. With the arrival of Allen Dulles in 1952, this pattern of recruiting and promoting white Anglo-Saxon Protestant students from America's most aristocratic families and backgrounds accelerated. These recruits were not selected on merit, but on class, lineage, and connections. As a result, many experienced and skilled former Army officers from World War II and Korea left the agency. The individual membership of the CIA wasn't published during this period, but existing evidence seems to confirm they almost exclusively came from the elite of American society, with the majority graduating from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. Between 1944 and 1960, 25% of the CIA's top officials had at least one degree from Harvard. The CIA, through this recruitment policy built on lineage, nepotism, and prejudice, overlooked the vast gold mine of talent which resided in the United States. America had millions of native Russian, German, and Polish speakers which could have been drawn on to fight the early Cold War against the Soviet Union, in addition to tens of thousands of native Chinese speakers, the overwhelming majority of whom were very patriotic Americans who had proved this by their service in World War II. Had the CIA recruited from this pool of American citizens, our espionage efforts might have been far more effective. By 1952, Beadle Smith was out and Allen was finally made the head of the CIA, a position that he had pursued since the CIA's conception in the late 1940s. Most of the operations that took place during Allen's leadership of the CIA we have either covered in episode 111 or will be covering in future episodes about specific operations. Again, as we outlined in episode 111, Allen's tenureship over the CIA was marked not necessarily by the collection and analysis of intelligence, the CIA's primary responsibility, but by covert operations, coups, and psyops. Many of these operations in the short term were beneficial to the United States, and those that weren't were hidden from the public. However, in the long term, such operations damaged the long-term reputation of the United States and much of the developing world up to the present. Allen himself, in the end, was undid by one such covert operation which sought the overthrow of Fidel Castro in the Bay of Pigs operation, an operation we will examine in greater detail in a future episode. Fundamentally, though, the failure of the Bay of Pigs operation ended Allen's storied espionage career. Ostensibly, Kennedy bravely took the public blame for the failure at the Bay of Pigs. Nevertheless, it was impossible, in the eyes of many in Washington, that Allen could remain head of the CIA after such a colossal disaster under his watch. The Kennedy brothers, both John and Robert, were fond of him, and they knew that the Republicans would limit their attacks on Kennedy publicly if Allen was still director. However, Allen was forced to resign in 1961, along with the rest of the CIA's leadership. Despite retiring for government for a third time in 1961 at 69 years old, he remained a very busy man as ever. He traveled widely, spoiled his grandchildren, and gave them the attention he had denied his own children. He also appeared on television regularly. In 1963, he became part of the infamous Warren Commission, again a topic for another episode. Allen's age, though, began to catch up with him, and during the winter of 1964-65, he suffered some type of stroke. His reactions and speaking were visibly slower than what it had been. Yet he remained engaged in politics and endorsed Lyndon Johnson for president in 1964, the first Democrat he had supported since Woodrow Wilson. On Christmas Eve 1968, Allen caught a mild case of the flu. However, he never recovered and had to be taken to the hospital. He died at 1 a.m. on January the 29th, 1969, 3 months short of his 76th birthday. In his day, Allen never achieved the public prominence of his older brother, but was just as influential. Indeed, over the course of half a century, from the First World War to the early Cold War, Allen was an influential figure in American espionage and diplomacy. He was looked to by many American presidents for advice and insights on foreign affairs. Like many figures in history, he is almost all but forgotten amongst the general public, but his influence can still be seen today in the shape of the world's politics and in the shape of the CIA, which was so influential in forging the world over the course of the late 1940s and 50s. The sources I utilized in the creation of this episode were 1. Allen Dulles Spymaster by Peter Gross, 1994. And the second was Allen Dulles Master of Spies by James Sorids, 1999. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did enjoy this episode or any of our previous episodes, please share the episode with your friends and family or give us a positive review on iTunes or the platform of your choice. As always, I want to thank our Patreon contributors and those who have made one-time donations for making this show possible. If you want to follow us on social media, check out the pictures for this episode, ask questions, or donate to the podcast, check out the website again at www.historyofthecoldwarpodcast.com. Well, there, don't forget to fill out our survey so that you can help us to bring you a better show.